Welcome to the Eastern Shore Journal with Tom Herz, a podcast dedicated to the Eastern Shore, its traditions, and the people who live here. We are all here for our own reasons. Some were born here and perhaps have deep, storied roots linking them with the past. Others have come here to retire and enjoy a quiet, peaceful life. And still others are here to raise their families and take advantage of work-life balance that is difficult to achieve in other parts of the country. I'm here for that third reason. And once I found the Eastern Shore, I realized it had everything I needed to live a complete life while still providing access to large population centers such as Washington, D.C., Baltimore, and Philadelphia. There's a lot to explore around our Eastern Shore, but to begin, I want to take a long look at why this part of the world is so special. In this season of Eastern Shore Journal, we'll explore a statement I heard years ago that I never fully understood until I started this project. The Eastern Shore is the last unspoiled colonial landscape in the United States. In talking through this statement with local residents who work every day to protect this legacy and pass this heritage on to the next generation, we'll strive to more fully understand what makes the Eastern Shore, and specifically Kent County and Chestertown, Maryland, such wonderful places to live, work, and explore. I'd like to share some of those conversations with you.
The Eastern Shore Journal, produced in cooperation with Hometown Multimedia.
Welcome to the Eastern Shore Journal with Tom Herz. I'm Tom Herz, and I'm here today with Elizabeth Watson, the principal at Heritage Strategies, LLC. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hey, it's good to see you.
It's good to see you. So we're exploring a theme with these podcasts, and the theme is the beauty of the Eastern Shore, right? Why is it important? What is it about the Eastern Shore that makes it so special? Its people, its traditions, its landscape. And so I'm bringing you in as sort of an expert on that topic, but also because years ago, you said something to me that's become sort of a meditation, or maybe that's too strong a word, you know, just something that I've thought about over the years, and it's sort of informed how I enter the Eastern Shore as someone who's not originally from here, has, you know, perhaps a different perspective. And that is that the Eastern Shore is an original colonial landscape. It is probably the best example of a colonial landscape in the Mid-Atlantic, certainly, but on the East Coast. And I thought maybe you and I could talk about that a little bit, right? Because that's a pretty bold statement and what that means, right? Because as I drove through the county after you had said that, I was like, well, there's a telephone pole and there's a factory, or there's, you know, a modern building or whatever it was, right? A road, a highway. But then as I began to think about it a little bit more, I began to see the depth of that statement, right? It's not just the landscapes, it's more than that. And I wonder if maybe you might talk a little bit about that.
Sure. You know, once upon a time when I was early in my career driving randomly in Pennsylvania, I don't know why, I was in a valley. And I had finished writing Saving America's Countryside, which came out first in 1989. It came out in second edition in 96. And so it was sometime in that time frame, and I'm driving up this valley, and I realize I am not seeing new things. And I found it kind of creepy, because to me, the modern stuff that we're seeing in this landscape is just one more layer. It means the community's alive, that it's still producing, you know, agriculture, still producing, you know, the folks in town are still doing their work, and everybody's spending enough money that the landscape stays alive. That's mm-hmm. important. And so, you know, what we're saying about the Eastern Shore, when we say it's singular, is that it laid down its bones, if you will, really before Europeans were here. The American Indians changed this landscape, too. Mm-hmm. This place was a savanna before Europeans colonized it. The savanna is intermittent trees in a landscape of, you know, golden grasses, mm-hmm. if you can imagine that. And so when the Europeans got here, they sort of took over the pathways and the fields. You know, where Indians were farming was good farmland. That's where people would settle. So the bones were there between the natural resources and the impact of the American Indians on the landscape. Then the Europeans get there, and they get there early. Mm-hmm. They're here in Kent County in 1650.
Wow.
That's a very early date for settlement. I mean, Jamestown is sort of the touchstone for this region is 1608.
Sure.
So not long after the Ark and the Dove in St. Mary's County, which is 1634, mm-hmm. You know, we have people settling basically down on Eastern Neck, where is the National Wildlife Refuge is
sure.
now. There's some very early archaeological sites in there as well. So, you know, and then they sort of move up the peninsula, if you will, between the Sassafras and the Chester Rivers.
Right.
But what happened here is they found tobacco. Tobacco didn't do real well up here. By 1750, they changed over to wheat. But even so, from the very beginning, because this area was one of the great interchanges on the global maritime highway, the Chesapeake Bay was incredible. You mm-hmm. had amazing access. I mean, we don't think that way anymore right. here in Kent County, but it was more natural to get in a boat than it was to get on a horse
sure.
in most parts of this landscape.
Wow.
So this landscape got wealthy early.
Right. And when you say access, talk a little bit more about that.
It's important markets. It's so important to be able to sell your goods.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yes, you can survive in this landscape and shoot ducks and raise a little bit of gardening, you're fine.
Right.
But if you want to make a living, mm-hmm. you got to have people you sell your goods to or your services or whatever. However, the modern market is a whole lot different than it was back then. Commodity markets. How do you sell your flour? How mm-hmm. do you sell your hogs? How do you sell your timber? You know, how do you sell your boats?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was some manufacturing, if you will. So you know, where do you get nails? That kind of thing. So, you have to have access to that market, and that's transportation.
Mm-hmm.
So, and sailing was the way you got around in the 17th and 18th centuries, just mm-hmm. was. Especially on this landscape, where you had to cross a lot of rivers.
Right.
Most people had boats. So basically, the property owners got wealthy enough to leave a legacy on the landscape of buildings that remain.
Mm-hmm.
The buildings just keep standing. Now, that was the case everywhere. You know, it's just that what happened here is the further industrialization and urbanization that would have happened around or did happen around Baltimore, say,
mm-hmm.
didn't happen here because in the 19th century, the age of sail ended. By the end of the 19th century, you know, they're still sailing ships even today, of course, but mm-hmm. by the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, the last of the great sailing ships are just gone.
Right.
So we have railroad by that time. In 1868, here in Kent County, we got our little railroad,
right.
which is eligible for the National Register. and our roads began gradually improving. And
right.
So we could continue to sell our agricultural goods, but we didn't have water power. So we didn't get the industrialization that you get around Baltimore, you know, with mm-hmm. the Patapsco Falls and all that sort of stuff.
Sure.
And because we're not growing to the extent that an industrialized community would grow,
mm-hmm.
we don't get the urbanization either. We just don't.
Right.
And yet, we're wealthy enough that we keep going.
Sure.
And that's the other secret of this landscape, is it was wealthy from the beginning, and it never really suffered. I mean, there's yellow fever in the early 19th century. There's almost nothing in this landscape between 1910 and 1930 that got built, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no, Greek revival is kind of rare in this area, which is antebellum, pre-Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a gentle up and down of the economy. And over time, technology changes, architecture changes, our culture changes. And with each decade, we lay down a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
It's still there. Because nothing came along to scrape it away,
right.
like urbanization and industrialization would do, or highways, you know, nowadays.
Sure.
Or urban renewal and all the things that cities and, you know, most Americans know took place in the mid-20th century.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically what we have here. It's, you know, it's kind of a little miracle.
Yeah.
We're just 15 minutes too far from anywhere to have had the pressure that, say, Queen Anne's County has had to deal with.
Sure.
We don't have as much shoreline. An accessible shoreline is Talbot County.
Sure. Harris.
So you just don't have the factors that changed other landscapes as radically
mm-hmm.
elsewhere. Here, we just have this gentle set of forces that are continuing to let the landscape evolve
mm-hmm.
very nicely. you know, and it's a good life for many people here.
Right. So then let's talk about the people a little bit, right?
Sure.
So what are some of the impacts of the history on the people here? And I'm thinking specifically of the farming community, agricultural community, but certainly also the waterman community as, you know, oystering and crabbing and whatnot came on.
Right.
And I guess that would have been in the early 20th century, late 18th, or I'm sorry, late 19th century?
Mid-19th on was the maritime. But, I mean, you could make, there was fishing from the beginning here.
Sure.
And that actually is one of the, if you stop to think about the East Coast landscape from Maine to Florida, okay, north of here, you got New Jersey. It's all swamp. It's, you know, it's barrier islands. It's sand. It's marshes. It's not farmable.
Right.
And you keep going, it gets rocky. You know, Long Island's a little bit like us because you've got, you know, maritime and you've got pretty good farmland. Long Island's actually a moraine from the glacial times.
Mm-hmm.
Above the moraine is rock. Hmm. You know, the Massachusetts colonists were dealing with an entirely different set of natural resources. And for reasons that are interesting, we can talk about if you want, they prospered up there.
Mm-hmm.
Had more to do with the climate and the water quality and the health. That you could be healthier in the north than you could be in the south. But you keep going. There's not, and then you go south of here. You get into Virginia and North Carolina, swamps again, swamps and sand, all the way down to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
You do not have great farming next door to great fishing except here. So you have another good factor for the economy, another healthy piece of the economy. You're diverse. You know, you don't have to rely just on agriculture. You've got watermen also.
Right. Sure.
Now, one of the unhealthy things about this economy was slavery.
Mm-hmm.
We had enslavement here almost from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
It was really more common to see enslavement by the end of the 17th century and by 1720. By 1720, you started to have, in Maryland, the sort of wealthy elite emerged.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I actually have roots in the time frame of the 17th century here. And my family picked up and moved in 1720 when the Carolinas opened.
Because
poor people could do better going to some other land.
Sure.
And so you had people owning people. And there's a really great book about 19th century Maryland and enslavement and how it affected the state. And the communities that had deep slavery did not prosper as much. So we might have done a little bit better had we had a little bit more entrepreneurship than reliance on human capital, the way that economy functioned. But, you know, it is what it is. That's what we had. And
sure.
We now enjoy a wonderful, thriving African-American community here whose roots go as deep into this landscape as anybody else.
Sure.
And we had free villagers here in the 17th and 18th century. There's a long history of free African-American participants in this community as well.
Did the transition from tobacco to wheat impact that the slavery culture here on the Eastern
Shore? Fabulous question. Absolutely. What happens is you do not need the intensive human labor that slavery provided to grow tobacco. When you're growing wheat, you got a field, you got somebody that's got to harvest it, you got to seed it, you got to harvest it, but you don't have to tend it. You don't have to do all the sort of lots of the handwork that goes with tobacco culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so yes. And so you start seeing manumissions here before the Revolutionary War.
I'm sorry,
manumission, freedoms, the emancipation.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm. And basically handing their freedom back to the servants that you have there enslaved. And so they are given their freedom. So we have people who can trace their roots back to free African Americans here in this community down into the 18th century.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
So then talk to me a little bit about heritage strategies, right? So how does heritage strategies kind of take all, I mean, and we could talk probably for hours about the history of this area, right?
Yeah.
And we're going to, because we have guests on to talk about some of that history. But the question is, how do we surface it? And then how do we protect it? And how do we pass it on to the next generation? And maybe that's a really big question.
It is. and I've had a really big career trying to deal with those kinds of questions with a lot of communities. I'm based here in Chestertown because I was recruited to be the first executive director of the Stories of the Chesapeake Heritage Area. Mm-hmm. I helped as a consultant in the 1990s here, working with both Queen Anne's County and Kent County on different projects that kind of helped emerge this idea, while we are special, maybe we should do something that helps that along. Yeah. And
for the record, we're going to have the current executive director of Stories of the Chesapeake
Gail
Heritage,
Owings.
Gail
right.
Owings, on to talk yes. about what is actually going on presently today.
Yes.
But I'm sorry, I didn't mean
that's,
to interrupt.
That's fine. Gail and I worked together. She was on the board and helped to found the whole heritage area. Mm-hmm. And so I spent 8 years here from 2002 to 2009 working as the director of the heritage area. And when that came to an end and I had decided to, it was time for me to, I was 8 years doing mm-hmm. that. It's a long time. And I had a friend who wanted to start a business with me, and we'd worked together before. We'd done very well, and he's now my business partner. And so we founded the company in 2009.
I see.
And we, you know, took some of the things that I had experienced here on the road. One of the things that I like to tell my clients, I have planned more than a dozen now national heritage areas, like Stories of the Chesapeake, but recognized by Congress across the country. Mm-hmm. But I'm one of the rare people who actually has had to live with her own plan. I did a plan for Stories of the Chesapeake and learned kind of what I might do differently with others. So I had a lot of experience to
in,
take.
In the tech world, we call it, dog fooding. You had to actually eat your own product.
Yes, that's perfect. That's exactly it. That's exactly it, you know, and nonprofit management, the kinds of things that you do. My practice also includes historic preservation planning. Mm-hmm. I'm finishing a plan for Somerset County, New Jersey, which includes a plan for preservation of agriculture and preservation of open space along with historic resources. Because as I think the little story of Kent County's landscape tells you, open space and farming and historic resources are all one. Historic preservation is just not about buildings. It's right. about all the kinds of factors that create the landscape and the place that we love to live in here.
Sure.
Yeah.
So we've talked about the landscape, right? We've talked about the history. And some of the people that make up that history. Now let's talk about some of the places, right? So what are some of the places here that that you feel are unique or special
sure.
and are worth mentioning?
Well, let's talk about Coxfield first, because I got to thinking about Coxfield just the other day. One of the things that, if you want to fast forward to what I'm up to now in Kent County as a volunteer, sure. I'm with the Kent Conservation and Preservation Alliance. I'm on their board of directors. And when I was working on the plan, as I began being the executive director for the heritage area, we did a study of this landscape. And then we got involved, KCPA was born because there was a threat of some wind power development in this county on the higher ground, which is only 60 feet above sea level, but you know. Mm-hmm. But that's a plateau up there. And so we fought that, the good fight, and we won, and then decided that we'd better get our cultural landscape chops a little bit more in gear. And so we brought back someone who had been involved in that original study, and we did the next level, which is called a preliminary cultural landscape study. You can see it on KCPA's website, kentalliance.org. And that study basically helped us see the landscape even more deeply. And so one of the cool things about it is if you get a topo map of Kent County, there's this odd little, not sure exactly geologically how it happened, but we have the upper part of the county from Route 20 up toward Delaware. That's a big piece of landscape. And you get up there, you know, you're up there by Shrewsbury and you're on Route 213 and you mm-hmm. have this big sky feeling.
Yep.
That's because you're on a plateau. And it's exceedingly good farmland. And so there's not a lot of forests that block your view. So, you know, you get there. And, you know, Tom Vilsack is back to being USD secretary mm-hmm. now under President Biden. He was secretary under Obama back when I was around. I didn't get to meet him, but he was flown over this entire peninsula. I mean, mm-hmm. well, a lot of things I'm saying about Kent County are true elsewhere as well.
Of course.
And he was flown over this landscape and could not get over how much it looked like Iowa. And if you've been to Iowa, there's not a lot of trees there either. And yeah. it's also very rolling, beautiful, you know, well-farmed land. And this is just a really, really rare spot. Mm-hmm. Odd little things like, you know, some of the best dark sky on the East Coast is here. Mm-hmm. So we're doing a film. And we raise the money to do the study. And then Janet Christensen Lewis, who's the chairman of the organization, said to me one day, "Oh, Elizabeth, we just don't want this study to sit on the shelf. Why don't we do a film?" And I went, "No!" And why did I say no? Well, that's because I've already done a film. I did a film in the early 1990s on Chesapeake Bay. It's the one that many people know. It was narrated by Walter Cronkite. And unfortunately, even though it's more than 25 years old, it is still all too true. Mm-hmm. They were still dealing with pollution and the problems of the bay. So I've been through that. And I was like, oh. But we raised the money with the help of some generous donors here in the county, as well as the Maryland Heritage Areas Authority. Mm-hmm. And Maryland Public Television, MPT, will come out with a documentary, and we hope a year. The pandemic has slowed things down, but basically trying to help people see this landscape. Mm-hmm. So yesterday, the producer was in touch with me about, well, what do I do? Can I get out in the snow? And I think I want snow shots, and I was giving her a little tour. So that's how I thought about Cox Field, because here's why Cox Field is interesting. I mentioned the topo. If you follow Route 20, and actually, you drop down and you go down to Rickard's Branch, okay? Mm-hmm. Between Route 20 and Rickard's Branch, there is this hill. And if you leave, when you leave Chestertown and you climb that long hill coming out of Chestertown and going up on 20, mm-hmm. you're getting up on the plateau. You are penetrating up through that ridge mm-hmm. and onto the high ground, the 60 feet high ground. And that's a landform. So along the other side, over toward the Chesapeake Bay side, Cox Field is on that high ground. That's why our militia were there. And the British were at a disadvantage coming up from the shore, right. coming through what would later be Georgetown. Georgetown itself was not there, the little Georgetown, the little village there mm-hmm. With a wonderful African-American church in the middle. Anyway, they came up through that area and met our militia at that hill. Mm-hmm. So if you want to really understand... battlefields are always about terrain. Yeah. And so it's really cool to sort of know that about the landscape and go see it. So, you know, I can take you sort of verbally all over the county for stories like that. Yeah. But it's quite remarkable. People, I think, understand when they drive down to sort of just Quaker Neck and all that whole area down there. You understand that's a little different. And why is that? It's mm-hmm. because the terrain is different. It's mm-hmm. different soils. It's muck soils. It has more trees because it's not as good farmland, mm-hmm. and it's sandier soil up at the top on top of that plateau. So, those kinds of factors are what tell you where to go look for historic resources. Mm-hmm. Where in the earliest 19th century could you come up a stream and find a good place to build a church?
Right.
So St. Paul's. You know, that's at the top end of a stream, which I've just recently got to go up on a kayak. It's kind of cool. All of these little churches that are in that part of the world were built out of brick. Well, they're built out of brick because there's clay there.
Yeah.
And there's trees there because you don't grow fields on clay, you grow trees on clay. So it all kind of, in my mind, works together.
Yeah.
So what other kinds of stories you want to hear?
Well, so you touched on it. And I think it's a really important issue, but the idea of pollution and the health of the Chesapeake Bay being probably chief among most, you know, thoughts of people that live in the Eastern Shore, but pollution generally, right, and preservation of farmland, but then also sort of clean energy, right, and where is that, where are you on that, right?
Sure.
Because, like, what I'm hearing is preserve, protect. There's a pollution problem with generally, but certainly with the Chesapeake Bay. So what about clean energy solutions, right?
Sure.
Why wouldn't we want something like that? And I know that this is a touchstone issue, and mm-hmm. and I'd just like to hear your thoughts on
mm-hmm.
that, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No, we absolutely need clean energy. Some of the things that I read as a environmentalist are just terrifying. I just hate hearing about the loss of habitat. You know, a good friend of the Delmarva Peninsula is Tony Hiss is coming out with a new book about how do we save, you know, enough habitat to save the species that we're losing as climate changes. So a lot of things, and we've definitely got to get carbon out of the atmosphere. So how do you think about farming and renewable energy in a landscape like this? Okay, first of all, one of the things that's nice to know is as electricity has to travel from remote rural places like us to the places that actually need the energy, like, say, Baltimore, you lose energy along the way. The further the generation of the electricity is from its use, the more you lose in terms of its efficiency and transmission. So that's one thing that it's helpful to understand. It would be better to be putting this solar energy close, so that as long as we're going to have to spend all this extra money to build this renewable stuff, we may as well not lose it in transmission.
I see.
And, in fact, there's a lot of brownfields, a lot of parking lots, a lot of rooftops. The buildings have to be built strong enough to hold solar. So mm-hmm. not all buildings without reinforcement would work. But there's a lot. There's 100,000 acres in Maryland now that could take solar that is not farmland.
Mm-hmm.
It's more than we need. More than the current goal in 2028 of, you know, carve-outs and all that sort of stuff. I won't go into all the
sure.
solar stuff. I unfortunately know more than I ever intended to learn about
right.
energy
right.
planning in this
right.
world. So, you know, that's one piece of it, is where should we site this stuff? Well, the reason it wants to go on farmland is because it's easy. It's cheap.
Mm-hmm.
The solar developers are getting paid gazillion bucks in terms of tax credits and solar RECs and all this other stuff to build. They're looking to minimize their costs. Where is it cheapest to go? Furthest away you can get from Baltimore, because the land is cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
And where do you go? You go to the farmland, because you don't have to cut the trees.
Mm-hmm.
Although we did see a case just recently where, you know, in some pretty significant habitat in Charles County, Georgetown University wanted to have a solar field. They're going to take down most of the site was forested. They're going to take them all down.
Wow.
So you get these weird, I mean, we're just in the beginning of understanding how to do this well. And I think a lot of environmentalists who play around in the policy world of energy and air quality and those kinds of things, they do not really understand land use and siting issues like this. And so we've got this kind of clash that's going on.
Sure.
The other thing, two things about farmland. One is we're going to need to feed 9 to 10 billion people on this planet by 2090.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of people. And unfortunately, most people don't understand the kind of farmland we have around here. This is rare worldwide, really rare,
mm-hmm.
truly rare. And particularly with climate change and the shift that's going to be going with drought and storms and all the other stuff that's going on, this land is incredibly valuable. Why would we ever use it for something that can go on rooftops and brownfields over by Baltimore?
Sure.
Okay. So that's one piece of the other that's really cool that a lot of people have not really understood until quite recently. Is that good farming that plows in nutrients, that plows in carbon, can sequester carbon. The more that you have pastures, the more that you have rich farming where you're reusing things like poultry manure and the other kinds of things, if you're enriching the soil, it holds carbon. And it actually can take carbon out. There are some studies that suggest that if we farmed the way we could,
mm-hmm.
we could actually get to pre-industrial levels of carbon. That's a big claim, and I'm not going to try to support it here, but it yeah. is worth, anybody who's interested in this issue should be looking at it.
Yeah.
And they were not modeling
yeah.
carbon sequestration through farming until just recently. And it's very interesting to hear, you know, the new team that's come on with President Biden, they're already talking about it. So it's out there, is understood at the sort
yeah.
of policy level now.
Yeah.
So why would we pave over, effectively, that's what solar does on farms, pave over ground that can actually be used to take carbon out of the air. There's
yeah.
another way to, you can skin both cats. This is the thing. Let's figure out how to do this well. And yes, we're thrashing around and we're figuring it out and we're playing around with incentives and we're helping developers just get there because we got to get there. You know, I get it, but it's churn right now and
yeah.
we're not doing things really well.
Yeah. Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much. This has been incredibly interesting. And let me ask you, you've mentioned a few resources over the course of our time together. If people wanted to reach out or they wanted to find out more information about some of the things that you've talked
mm-hmm.
about, could you offer some resources?
Sure. I'll go back to kenalliance.org because on that site, there are two things. One is after we got done with the study, you can find the study on that site. You just look under resources, and both of the things I'm about to tell you, the study is there. You can go and read that if you like. And then the other is we did something a little bit more accessible. It's called a story map. And what that is, it's a special website that takes mapped information and helps people visualize it. So we took some of the themes that came out of our study, the landscape, African American heritage, maritime heritage, other things. There's a little video of Coxfield's battle in there. Wow. It's really fun to watch. Someone else had created that, and we asked to use it. So you can, and you just, there's a lot of tabs, and you just go through, and you'll see images and text and other kinds of resources that will tell you very much about this. The other I would recommend is Kent County's Historical Society. It's a wonderful website, and our website crosses over to there. So there's some real easy digital access at this point. Lots to read in the library, but I think start with some of that, and you'll find a gazillion resources to enjoy.
Thank you so much for your time.
The Eastern Shore Journal, produced in cooperation with Hometown Multimedia.
Thank you for joining us today. I would like to thank Brian Moore and Leslie C. at WCTR for their help and support in creating this podcast, and offer special thanks to Pat Haley, my producer, for all of his hard work getting these episodes published to you. The views presented here are my own.